listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 166 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is the one and only Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
I'm stressed.
You're stressed?
I'm stressed. So, you know, we in the past, and probably many times, we've covered the topics of like album release mistakes and things you should avoid doing, and always at the top of the list is... you remember the most common one. Make sure you have your CDs on time for the release, for the album, the date of the album release. Well, that's not the one I made, but I'm experiencing a completely new problem, which I've never experienced before. It's almost the flip side of that. The release show is tomorrow. The venue contacted me today and said, oh, crap. They're actually not a venue, which is why this whole thing happened. It's a space I found, and they were really into throwing the show, and I was going to set up and bring the sound and all this. They contacted me today and said, we don't have an event license, and your show was so widely publicized. I had a front page story in the newspaper that the police and City Hall contacted them and basically said, if you throw this party, we will revoke your business license.
There's nothing more rock and roll than that.
I think
you know the answer. You throw that party. The police come. You get more video.
Right.
And this should end with you in handcuffs, even if it's staged.
And I'm in handcuffs, and they're out of a job.
They've got to do their part for rock and roll.
Yeah.
It'll be a story they'll tell their grandchildren, though.
Well, in out of respect for the rest of their lives, I'm trying to find, and they're helping me. They're contacting a bunch of other places nearby because they're figuring, you know, some people are still going to show up at that place. And if it's a walking distance alternative, then, you know, some of those people will still come to the show. Hopefully all of them will. But anyways, that's my stress for the day.
Wow, that is a new one.
One day's notice.
I thought we were going to lead off with talking about how you got that lovely one-page, front-page, giant photo feature on your hometown newspaper.
That was the easy part. Holding on to the venue is the hard. In fact, I'd be better off if I'd not gotten the press coverage, because maybe then we could have just done it underground. And
there you go. See, that's the problem with press. It puts you on the cop's radar, and you never know what can happen. Who knew you had to have an event license?
Yeah, I think they've only had music there two or three times. I've played there once before on like a kind of First Friday art walk sort of deal. But it didn't matter then, obviously. But
wow.
Red tape.
Red tape. That's the world we live in. You can't even show up and play music without a license these days. Wow, that is stressful, and that is a new one. I have not heard of that happening where somebody gets so much press that I should say I've probably heard about that happening with like a fire marshal, but not like the cops revoking someone's business license for not having an event license. But, well, I hope it works out for you.
I hope I have a show.
You can always stand outside, just put a stage up outside. I mean, technically, it's not inside the venue.
Then I'll get arrested for some sort of busking violation.
Well, just make sure there's video. I want to see video of all of this.
You don't care what happens as long as there's video.
As long as it's video and it's dramatic, you'll get great mileage out of it. All right, well, best of luck with you on that one.
Thanks.
All right. Well, you know, we've had a lot of new listeners discovering the podcast lately because we've been doing more episodes and we've had it featured in some of the CD Baby newsletters recently. So we've gotten some feedback from newbies to the podcast. First off, I want to say welcome. Welcome to everybody who's just been discovering the podcast. We're glad to have you. And I wanted to take a quick moment and explain the format of our podcast because it's morphed over the years. And someone, wrote in saying, why did it take you so long to get to the discussion point? I think it was the one where we were discussing your release on blogs, the featured releases kind of discussion we had a couple weeks ago. But anyway, the podcast, we've been around since 2007. And the format we sort of adopted was that we would have an interview with a guest And then on the following episode, we would do a roundtable discussion about the topic covered by that guest. And then we'd also have some news and some listener feedback and all that. And, you know, since we don't always have a guest, we decided that recently we would just stop doing it, calling it a roundtable discussion, and just have a topic that we discuss and it be sort of our roundtable style podcast. And in that podcast, we like to have some opening banter. And, you know, the main reason of that is that we like to, for the listeners to get to know who we are. We try to keep it about music. You don't hear us talking about our kids or what we're doing on the weekend outside of music. But to let you guys know that we're musicians, we're actively pursuing things. Chris is going to get arrested this weekend, for example. Very relevant to you understand who we are, so you know where we're coming from and what sort of authority we have on the topics. Then we like to hit some news when there's some good news that we think is important for the indie artist community to know about. And then, you know, we have our discussion on old episodes. Like I said, we reflected on past shows, and now we're just trying to make that, a time where we discuss the topic at hand. If you don't want to hear all the stuff that comes before the discussion, if you skip about 15 minutes ahead, you'll probably land right on the discussion portion. And then we get into our listener feedback, and if we have emails or calls to share, this is how we like to cap off the show. So that's an explanation of what we've been doing. When we have a guest, we don't do those things with the guest. We just have the interview. But so that just wanted to explain everything. If there's an outcry from the listener community that we should no longer do this format, we're happy to change, but this is kind of what we've fallen into. And you know, all the podcasts I enjoy are longer format podcasts, so I like having more to listen to. Actually, when I have a podcast and it's just 15 minutes long, I kind of go, okay, I'll listen to it, because I like, you know, something that's going to fill up the whole drive home and while I'm out working in the yard and, you know, walking around with my phone in my pocket listening to podcasts.
Yeah.
So that, I just wanted to explain the format to everyone, because we have a lot of new folks listening and some people are asking questions. So there it is. And don't forget to subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. And we love reviews, especially good reviews that you can leave there. But that's it.
It's a good caveat to put on that.
Yeah. So does that explain everything, Chris? Are you going to stop sending me emails asking why it's taking so long to get to the discussion?
Stop asking me about my life.
No, I think it's important, and there's a reason why I will mention when we get to the discussion portion of why hearing about what our personal pursuits are in music at the moment is relevant to the show. That's the banter portion, like I mentioned. So now we're going to move into the news portion. Are you ready, Chris? Because there's some news.
Excellent segue.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
All right. There's some big news stories that happened recently. There's a temporary sigh of relief over at SoundCloud as they have finally inked a deal with Sony Music, the last major label catalog holdout that was preventing SoundCloud from launching its own paid streaming service. Now that SoundCloud is fully licensed, rumors are flying that SoundCloud could have a new paid service up and running in weeks rather than months. The pressure is definitely on to make an impact with the new service and get the financial picture for SoundCloud headed in the right direction. No reports have surfaced on how this might impact the way the site currently functions, but stay tuned for more updates. Daniel Ek, the CEO of Spotify, announced that Spotify has officially crossed the 30 million subscriber mark. That means Spotify has seen 50% growth in paid subscribers since its announcement that it crossed the 20 million mark back in June 2015. Not only is this growth in volume impressive, but the time frame in which it occurred shows that mass adoption to paid streaming is underway. The RIAA released some interesting data on sales revenue for 2015. In terms of formats and revenue streams on the decline, CDs were down 17%, but they still made up 21% of the total revenue picture. Song downloads were down 12%, but they still made up 17% of the total picture. Album downloads were down only 5%, but just made up 15% of the total revenue picture. And on the flip side, where the growth is coming from, Subscription paid streaming was up 52%, and that was 17% of the total revenue picture. Internet radio, non-interactive streaming, basically Pandora, was up 3.8%. That made up 11.3% of the total revenue picture. Vinyl was up 32% and made up 6% of the total revenue picture. And ad-supported free streaming was up 30% and made up 5.4% of the total. And then they said sync royalties were up 7%, and that made up 2.9% of the total. But I'm not exactly sure how they were figuring all that up with sync royalties. Seems like that'd be hard to really calculate that and have a true number. But anyway, that's the news. There's some interesting things happening. Clearly, streaming is the 2016 is definitely the year of streaming, where in 2017, people not engaged in a streaming format in some capacity will start to feel foreign. But so 2016, lots of adoption happening on streaming. But I think some of the numbers there, the CDs still making up 21% of the overall revenue picture. I was sort of surprised at how big a chunk it still has. It still had the biggest chunk.
Yeah, why not? That makes sense to me. Like, in terms of CD sales at CDBaby.com, you know, like, it seems like for independent artists and for, you know, artists on small labels, that seems to still be kind of the bread and butter. So it makes sense to me.
I would assume these are being reported for live sales as well, because that there's better systems in place to do that than when I was touring, supporting brand new releases on labels. But that's a big deal too. If you're touring, you know, CDs still sell great.
Yeah, the thing that was I found interesting is when Spotify hit the 20 million subscriber mark was June of 2015, right?
Yep.
Which is basically right just before Apple Music launched. And so if they've gained 10 million since then, and Apple Music, I don't know what their subscriber rate is at, but
last number they said was, I think, 11 million,
which they gained fairly quickly, and maybe it slowed since then. But either way, it's, you know, just that thing that happens when there's competition, it actually drives more attention and awareness of the product and or the service in general, as opposed to, you know what I mean? Like, it kind of brings way more people into streaming in general, so it's good for everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems to be the case with that. It's not like Apple Music came in and just obliterated Spotify.
I know they did this right before Apple Music launched, and they did it definitely did it at Christmas, but Spotify did 3 months of premium for 99 cents. So I know they got a lot of adoption. I know they did it in earlier on, but I bit for the one at Christmas, but I knew it wasn't their first time they did it because I saw the promotion before then. And so a lot of these people haven't really converted to the $9.99 monthly price at this time. But it's interesting because I'm sure that that campaign brought in a lot of new people streaming. But how long has Spotify been around? Since 2012 in the U.S.
I think even earlier, because they were in Europe for a year or two at least, right?
Yeah, but they had select countries. But as far as being worldwide, so it took them quite a while to get to 20 million users, and then in like 6 months they got another 10. So that's you know, a bit pretty big signal to what's going to be happening in 2016. And a lot of people are going to be trying a streaming service for the first time, or, you know, getting their feet wet with it and deciding how they go forward with their music. So, and, you know, SoundCloud inking that final deal with Sony Music, that was a big deal. That was all the talk at South by Southwest. Lots of people were talking about that because that happened while I was down there. And I, you know, the pressure's on now. Launch a streaming service. They have 170 million users. But will any of them pay for anything? You know, that's kind of the question. Will those users actually adopt a paid format, or are they already, you know, are all those 170 million people that want to pay for one already using Spotify or Apple Music, or, you know, there's others. There's Rhapsody, there's Tidal. So it'll be an interesting year. It'll be an interesting year.
And then it'll get even more interesting when Pandora jumps into the on-demand streaming.
Yep.
World.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, that was the news. There's some big items, but they're pretty straightforward. I thought, you know, there's some things happening. The industry's taking
shape. We've talked about a lot of that stuff before, too, though, so maybe we've kind of set our piece on those.
Yeah, and the revenue breakdowns I thought were interesting because, you know, it plays into our conversation that's coming up as well. So why don't we do ourselves a favor and just get right to the discussion?
And we'll do a favor for that guy who was not happy about the intros.
Yeah. Hey there, this is Kevin, and I just wanted to jump in here at the end of the news section with some breaking news. I was just about to post this episode when SoundCloud announced the launch of their streaming service named SoundCloud Go. It will be $9.99 for Android users and $12.99 for iOS users. The key advantage they claim is access to an expanded catalog. Obviously, this happened much quicker than we expected, and I'm curious to see what the artist community thinks. So if you have thoughts, be sure to email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or call our listener line at 360-524-2209. Are you going to be buying into SoundCloud Go? Are you going to pass on this one? Let us know. All right, back to the show. All right, so this week we are going to be discussing, should you release singles or albums, or singles versus albums as a strategy? And I don't know that we're really going to be putting it as a either or, but let me set the stage for the conversation and then we can move on from there. So we were at a conference and somebody who was a keynote from the stage stood up and said, stop releasing albums. Just stop it. And I thought that was very bad advice. And the person that was saying this was an artist, but I would call more of a former artist, not currently pursuing music anymore. And I thought I understood where they were coming from. And their main point they were trying to make was that stop sitting there trying to perfect 15 songs for 4 years and just get some music out there. That's really the essence of what they're saying, which I would agree with. But the idea of you should stop making albums didn't sit right with me. So today we're going to have a discussion about singles versus albums, when you should do it, maybe when you shouldn't do it. And going back to what I said about the beginning of at the beginning of the show, talking about why we have that little banter section so you can hear more about what Chris and I are up to and, you know, some of our current pursuits in music, is that I find that there's a lot of people who are out there giving artists advice that have never pursued music. And there's something that's very different about giving someone some very logical advice that makes sense, may even work in other industries. But then when you put it into the perspective of the creator, there's something very different about it. And, you know, it's like when you create this song and you're releasing it, it's a very personal thing to have created this thing and put it out to the world. And that makes you do things differently than you would if I just, you know, made some little cog and was selling cogs on the side of the road.
And there's also a number of different motivations for making music. It's not just simply profit driven. It's not simply to get the biggest amount of followers. There's lots of different things that bring people to the pursuit. So yeah, that a lot of that kind of more businessy advice doesn't usually address address the part of that creator who really is just trying to feed their soul or work some things out or whatever it might be. So
exactly. And you would be shocked at how many people I talk to, especially in the music tech space, that have no concept of any of that. And I bring those things up to them when they're pitching me their idea and they just deer in the headlights and like, why, you know, they don't understand that this is bigger than just trying to make a transaction. And so I think a lot of times that's left out of the conversation, that the real motivations of an artist aren't just to make money. There's some bigger things that you might be struggling with, or just creativity in general that brings you to the table. And that's part of the pursuit. And when you separate those two, I think the advice can be very faulty, or at least so generalized that people can get very wrong impressions from it. And to me, this is one of them, the singles versus albums debate. So With that being said, Chris, did you want to start talking about some of the benefits of singles? I've got you won't believe how much notes I wrote about taking releasing albums.
Yeah, so are we going to go point by point, or should I just sort of go through my whole list and then you'll go?
Let's go through your list, because I separated mine out in different buckets of why I think artists should be releasing albums.
Okay, so I'll start, and I should also just put a little disclaimer in here that I just put out an album. I've released many, many albums. I keep putting out albums. So I suppose my argument for singles is more theoretical in my own life, but it is something I've been thinking about trying for a number of the reasons I will mention soon. The first is cost. You know, when you measure cost in terms of time and money, putting out a full album really takes a lot. It takes a lot of time. Especially if you've got a whole band, you often need to go into a studio, you know, spend the time to get 12 songs, mix them, master them, replicate them. By the time that process is over, maybe a year has gone by, maybe 2 years. In my case, maybe 5 years has gone by. And so it's a lot of time, a lot of money. So contrast that with a single, which is just going to be a fraction of that, and you still, at the end of that process, have a product to put out. That's my first plus on the side of singles.
Which is what I've heard a lot of people say about releasing singles. It's cheaper.
Yeah. Were you going to follow that up?
In some circumstances, I was going to add, it's cheaper in some circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're Axl Rose, you're probably going to spend lots, even if you're putting out one song. But the second thing I thought, which was particularly attractive to me about this approach, is the speed. You know, like in the 50s and 60s, bands would go into the studio and they would sometimes have a record in stores the next week sometimes of a single song or an A and B side. So the speed to the market is great. And also not getting bogged down in all of that time it takes to complete the whole album. So you have this sense of achievement. I think along with that is the ability to really focus on one thing at a time, which is, again, for me, attractive in that it doesn't allow you to really start overthinking things and, you know, second guessing things. So you kind of get all hands on deck to bring this one song to life. And that can happen in a home studio. I think you could even go into a, you know, proper recording studio and experiment, you know, whether it's you've reserved a weekend to do the song, you know, you can still make it an experience that allows for some uncertainty and some excitement and discovery, but still you're just focusing on one song. So you can get in that creative space, take it from the beginning to end, and then, you know, a week later, put the thing out if you want. And because of that, I think there's a lot less, I don't know what you call it, maybe anxiety or kind of emotional baggage that can tend to build up the longer you wait to put something out. I know for me, you know, taking so long to put an album out became its own kind of obstruction because sort of fear and worry about its reception. And by the time the music is, you know, that old, you sort of hate it all anyways. With a single, you can avoid a lot of that. You do it, you put it out while it's still fresh and exciting to you. Obviously, it's going to be fresh and exciting to everyone that hears it, or, you know, at least fresh. And then there's, so I think that just seems very clean and simple to me. And then when you do a whole album, you're jumping oftentimes from song to song, part to part, and in all of that jumping around, I think you can lose focus and, like I said, get that self-consciousness going that, you know, you can overcook the thing. On the more like fan engagement, businessy side of things, I think one of the frequent arguments that's made in favor of singles is that it gives you more opportunities to connect with your fans. When you make an album, you can, like I said, kind of disappear for a year or more. And, you know, I know that you should be sort of sharing information about the recording with your fans for a whole album, and they should feel included. But really, we know that artists, when they're making music, most of the time are thinking about making the music, and capturing something for Facebook or for Instagram is secondary to getting the great drum beat or whatever. So a lot of times the promotion gets pushed to the back burner, and in the eyes of your fans, you've kind of disappeared. With a single, you totally address that, because every month or two you're putting out a new song. When you do that, it also means that you have a chance to write to bloggers and maybe set up a premiere, launch a video. You know, all of those sort of touch points that you can have, perhaps to a greater degree with an album, you at least can make up for in quantity with singles. And then people love making album covers and liner notes, and this way you get to do it every 2 months instead of once every couple of years. You can have a different album cover for every single you put out, which that's kind of cool. And then one other thing I thought would be important to mention is that, you know, the overwhelming majority of listening that's happening on streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music is singles. People are generally not listening to full albums. And so it goes back to that thing of like, these platforms allow us to get a glimpse into what people want, and what they want is singles. So give them what they want. You know, you can really think about every single song that you're making as a single, and you can assess it based on, you know, whatever qualities you think a single should have. But you can try to make it have the most impact as a just a solid piece of art that exists on its own, and not worry about, you know, filler content on an album or any of those little artsy connection pieces that we love so much in Pink Floyd albums or whatever. But I think it gives you a lot more of that, yeah, like kind of just smartly thinking about each song. And in doing so, you don't have to worry about making a cohesive album statement. You know, it's kind of like a early Beatles record. A lot of times, you know, their songs from track to track on an album don't sound anything the same. And it's because they thought about it like, we're going in and we're going to make one song today, and then next week we'll make another one. And they ended up with a bunch of singles that wound up on albums. But so again, I think that's kind of freeing, creatively freeing, and maybe freeing of some stress. And then one person who I know is in favor of this approach is a guy named Jay Frank, who's an author, and he owns a label called, I think it's pronounced DigSyn, like for digital single. And their model is to only release singles. He's kind of totally divorced himself from the idea of supporting albums anymore. And that allows him, I think, to have a lot more artists to work with, a lot more different kinds of opportunities to do things with those songs.
He hasn't heard my arguments for albums yet, though.
You're going to convince him back to the...
Oh, I thought of a lot of things that I hadn't even thought of before when I actually sat down and thought about it. But continue.
Well, that's probably the end of my bullet points, but maybe I'll have some counter-arguments.
Okay. Okay. One thing when you were talking that I realized that we should probably have stated is that when we're talking singles, we're talking individual songs. And the reason why I was just going to make sure that that's clear is the word singles in the history of the record business could mean a lot of different things. And typically it meant the one that you were releasing to radio.
The hit song.
The hit song.
Or the hopeful.
Yeah. Hopefully, no matter what kind of strategy you do, singles or albums, you're writing great songs, because no matter what you do, you need to have good songs. And that's a key piece to any artist's career. All right. So.
Oh, do we want to give a honorable mention to the EP at this point, or?
We will. I've got an email about that at the end. I got an email about that at the end. So let's see where to start. What was the thing you left off on? Because I actually took some notes while you were talking.
So I was thinking about how, you know, Spotify and Apple Music give us proof that what people want is singles. So in having a single release strategy based around singles, it gives you the opportunity to focus on every song as its own thing and not have to worry about how it ties in with other songs or some sort of cohesive sound. You can kind of just focus and put it out and give people what eventually they're going to digest anyways, which is just one of your songs.
I know what it was. You actually ended with that, talking about that label.
And, oh, right.
And I thought before I start my album, defense of the album, when you said that, I thought, you know, that's an interesting strategy and probably more beneficial for the label. And so I would just would say that, you know, with a lot of people saying, oh, just forget it, just release singles, that sometimes they're saying that and it's not necessarily in the artist's best interest, but it's definitely in that label's interest to funnel through artists faster and see what sticks.
That's true. And I know that when I heard him talk about the label, he did mention that kind of on the flip side of that, though, that when he has, you know, let's say he accepts a song from an artist, he gets it into a, you know, prominent playlist on Spotify. It gets a bunch of plays. It obviously makes he and the artist some money. But also then there's that attention that's brought to the artist's back catalog, which he has no interest in, you know, he has no financial interest in. So there is that kind of by him really promoting a single, he is helping the artist's other catalog, which oftentimes they own themselves. So
yeah,
that was one plus for his approach, I think.
All right, so here's where I'm going to start off with this. First off, I would characterize an album as a full meal versus a snack or an appetizer, which is just one-off songs.
Oh, you're getting poetic with this.
A lot of people will say that it's always been about the single. And I will say, but there is a difference historically in how that song was consumed and the context. So when we're talking singles, like I mentioned, you know, you're talking 50s and 60s music business. We're talking radio. We're talking hit songs. We're talking people driving in their car and everyone experiencing the same song together that's catchy and usually confined to some very strict guidelines as far as what qualifies as a radio single. But we're not in that world anymore. We're now we're talking about songs now in playlists on streaming services that the listener is discovering potentially on their own, maybe through a playlist or maybe just by searching around. So the context to me is very different, and what the intention of or how the user is experiencing that song, how it came about. So that's kind of just want to set that up. So strategy. Here's some things why I think an album is strategically a good thing. You need more songs to drive streaming revenue, a catalog, you know. You get more streams with a collection of songs put into an album format than you will with random one-off songs. And the reason being is that one song leads into another. People like putting albums on and letting it play in the background. You could say the same thing about playlists. It's an album, it's a way to curate your own catalog. This might change. Hopefully it will. But right now, streaming services are a mess when it comes to how they deal with individual songs in a search result. It's a frustration I've been experiencing as a user of multiple services where I search for an artist, I can recognize their albums, and beyond that, there's just all this random songs listed, and I have no idea what's what. And currently, most of it is usually B-sides, a lot of garbage that's out there that may have been on a soundtrack that was really just a half-hearted recording. Right now the catalogs of the streaming services still haven't figured this out yet. They haven't fully moved away from the album format. The average music listener is not a hyper playlist creator. Putting in an album on and letting it stream while they work, exercise, or sleep is so much easier, and they understand. I think a lot of the tech world likes to pretend to think that everyone's these hyper active users. And then we go back to like what Chris, you said about your mom. She just likes putting Pandora on and letting it play and she's happy. Mm-hmm. I think that pattern is more prevalent than people like to admit. And it's at this point where I should mention that we're not talking about Adele here. You know, we're not talking about Gwen Stefani, who had another, like, who just withheld her album from Spotify and has the number one album. We're talking about, you know, more the independent artist level, the small label level, the level where you don't have sheer market power to influence with one song. If you're touring, you'll still be able to sell a ton of albums, CDs, vinyl, even cassettes. People are selling cassettes again. I don't know why. It's really hard to sell a single at a show. So if you're selling, if you're touring and you say you release a bunch of singles over the course of the year, you're going to end up having to put them all together in some sort of collection in order to sell at your show. And if you're not doing that, you're missing out on money. Club bookers and press still see the album release as a newsworthy event. When you have, my note was, when have you ever seen a non-superstar artist get press or a better show slot because they released a new song? It just doesn't happen. But they will cover you on the front page of your newspaper if you do a video where you have to learn the songs backwards and fall into the pool 300 times.
And maybe I would have still gotten that story if that was the only song I released.
But it would have been about the video.
Yeah, it was partially about the video.
You have a point. So that was, I put all those things in a stretch. Oh, there's one other thing that I took note of, like paid album downloads are not declining as fast as song downloads. There's still more perceived value in an album that might have more perceived value as far as ownership as opposed to songs, where definitely when you jump into a streaming world, the idea of downloading an individual track from an artist that you're like, hey, I heard a song on the radio, that sounded kind of cool, that's going to... I've hit rock bottom this year, probably.
So paid album downloads didn't decline as fast, but wasn't the percentage quite a bit less than the paid single downloads?
It was 17 to 15% of total revenue. Songs had 17%.
And albums had 15?
Yeah.
That seemed like a lot to me. Okay.
But songs were dropping at 12%, almost 13%, where albums were only dropping at 5%. That was something I threw in last minute. We'll see. But when I looked at that, I thought, you know, if you're going to try and convince your fans to go buy the music, chances are you'll have a better chance of convincing them to buy an album than a song, because a song they'll be like, oh, just open up Spotify and give it a listen. So that was my strategic reasons for still doing an album.
Oh, you know, you just did remind me of one other thing that on the side of singles, though.
What's that?
If you are in a genre that's not so tied to the physical product, then singles make even more sense, because not only are you saving costs in terms of time and money for the process, but you don't need to replicate anything. You just put it up online, you put it on SoundCloud, you sell it on iTunes, and you're avoiding, you know, potentially thousands and thousands of dollars in having to even replicate.
I agree 100%. The number one genre where that is absolutely the case is EDM. And the interesting thing with EDM is that, you know, while they may only release one song, it may be 20 minutes long. So
right.
It's definitely a different format, and the way the fans engage with music is different. So yes, there are some genre considerations, where I would say on the flip side, if you're an Americana artist and you're not making CDs, you are throwing money away, because you will sell CDs. If you are doing country music, any genre that skews to an older audience, if you're not making CDs, then, you know, and releasing albums, you're probably not making as much as you potentially could. Where as an EDM artist making a CD, it just depends on what you're planning to do with it. That genre is different. Hip hop has some of that as well. There's still lots of hip hop artists releasing full albums, but they do tend to feel more like individual tracks, the way they produce them, than they do like a cohesive artistic experience. They'll have a lot of guest rappers and things like that. So moving into my artistic, the reason why my artistic bucket of why releasing an album is a good thing. Albums allow you to grow musically and make an artistic statement in context, important in context. A random song might just strike the listener as weird. Sort of like a scene from a movie compared to the whole movie, which has a long story and different scenes, different rhythms, different emotions. And so, like, if you have a really gut-wrenching, heartfelt song and you release it by itself, I could see that being, I don't know, out of context. It may not land like it would in the context of a greater album especially lyrically. I think that's where, if you go through this period of life where you went through something, in fact, I was listening to NPR this morning when my alarm went off, and they were interviewing an artist. I wish I could remember her name. She was a country artist, and the whole album was written in this really dark time in her life where they had twins, and one of them didn't make it. And it just sent her on this chain of events in her life that ended up her in jail and all these other horrible things. And all these songs were out of that and really spoke to very specific events. I think individually they would seem very dark, and they were, some of them were dark, but they kind of had upbeat country, major keys. You know, it was an interesting juxtaposition of the lyrics versus the music. But I think individually, some of those more heartfelt songs like that, where someone's just really going through some dark stuff, would not land in the context of just releasing an individual song in some cases. So the album provides a greater context for a bunch of different beats of emotion that together make sense. Then artistically, the artistic career has ebb and flow, and sometimes you need to go away and be in a creative space where ideas can build on one another. And this becomes more important, I think, as you start seeing success. Being in the studio to record 3 to 8 tracks compared to one where, you know, you start using some different sounds and you start experimenting, and it just gives you a little bit more space where, while I think artists can get trapped in a trap there and never release anything, I think on the single side, you could get in such a hurry to just crank out songs that you'd start doing the same thing over and over again. And the reference I have for that is every artist that I've seen try to do a song a month or a song a week, going way back in the podcast where we talked to Jonathan Colton, the production never grew. It was a challenge on the songwriting side to crank out that many songs, and he admitted that some of them weren't great. And that wasn't the point of that exercise, and that's not what he was trying to do. He was just trying to challenge himself to just not get stuck in a creative rut. But I think it's easy to just get in crank it out mode. And so there's a balance there. And, you know, the idea with an album, I think it's a challenge that, you know, I see a lot of artists, they'll write a couple good songs, they'll have one good song, they'll release it, and they never just spend time just cranking out more songs and working on their craft, because they don't need to force themselves to write more songs. And I don't think you should force yourself to release bad songs. But if you're thinking, oh, this year I'll release 4 songs, chances are the average person is not going to write 20. They're going to probably get closer to the number that they release. So that's the artistic side of it that I think, especially a lot of the people that say, stop releasing albums, they're not in that space. They don't understand that portion of it.
So I know I already mentioned this. My counter argument to that, in terms of getting in a creative space, is that I think you can still do that with a single. I think it's possible to carve a chunk of time out, get everyone in the group all firing on all cylinders, and to leave room for like the playing around and the, you know, taking yourself in a new direction. And maybe it's even more so because you know that this song is going to live on its own. You could try something really wildly outside of what you normally do. And it doesn't have to relate to a bunch of other stuff. So
I've got a counter to that argument coming up.
Okay.
In a different section. From the studio space though, I'll address that in a second. My next section was cost, and you mentioned singles being cheaper. And I would say that's only the case if you're doing all your recording at home, because if you're renting a studio, you're actually going to spend more time dinking around, miking up drums and all that setup stuff that, you know, is supposed to take an hour or two and ends up taking half the day or most of the first day until you get the sounds you're satisfied with. You're going to be doing that every time. And right, instead of just doing it once and then recording more tracks, and, you know, that's just more, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to release all those songs together as an album. You could still parse them out and do them individually. I'm just highlighting that, you know, if you're going, I'm going to record a song once a quarter and release it right when I'm done, mix it and master it and release it, that in the end, it's actually probably going to be more expensive because there's a lot of that setup time, unless you're recording at home. And there's some people that make amazing records in a home studio. Home studios are amazing these days, and they don't cost that much money. So that's an exception. And there's some genre exceptions as well for that. And, you know, cost-wise, you're still going to need an album cover. So now you need a designer to design 10 album covers instead of putting them all on one. Some people, that might be a positive.
No, maybe you just have the designer make one. You chop it up into 10 little squares.
That would be funny if it's just like this big white square, and then there's one puzzle piece that's put in, and then each album has the different one, and then some fan has to go together and put them all together in Photoshop.
Yeah, collect all 10.
There you go. See, you can make collectibles online. All right, my last section is fans. This is sort of from the fan perspective. If someone likes one of your songs, they're immediately going to start looking for another song or an album, in most cases. And the album format ensures they will find more to latch onto, especially quickly. And part of this is me referring back to what I talked about when you're in streaming services right now. Albums are still curated well, and songs seem just like scattershot. It's really hard. And in the song category is also, like, when you search an artist in the songs, that's where you start getting a bunch of search results that aren't even that artist. It might be a song named that. And so with the album, it's still for the fan. If they like a song, if they hear a playlist that has your song in it, then they can immediately go to a place where they are diving into more of your music and not having to dig around song by song.
I just want to know, who are these mythical fans that like more than just one song per artist? Who are these people?
I like two of your songs.
Did you have to listen to the whole album to find those two? Because I could have just released them as singles and you would have found them. But
the other ones were like the opening act. Which brings me to my next point. Lots of people will just gravitate to the hit and just consume that. But in order to turn those people into diehard fans, you're going to need a deeper experience. And the album provides that deeper experience. If I just want a hit song or a catchy song that I like, there's going to be lots of people that do that. But I'm thinking, if I'm going to turn those people into fans, they're going to want to feel some deeper connection to me as an artist. And an album feels like a deeper connection. It feels like the whole movement of the symphony as opposed to just, the first track.
Sure. And whether it's 20 years ago with Jagged Little Pill or last year with Taylor Swift's 1989, though those albums were full of what became like hit singles, they were full albums. So
yeah,
I guess that plays into your court there.
And then I had a couple a lot of these are all just, personal anecdotes, but the one that personal experience as a fan and as an artist, what really started getting me thinking about this is, if you've listened to the podcast for a long time, it's no secret I'm a big U2 fan. I wouldn't call myself a super fan, but anytime they release something, I'm there on day one. But I realized that it was like 2 years ago or something, they did this giant song release around the Super Bowl. They weren't playing, but they did a commercial. It was like a 2-minute commercial, and it played a bunch of their song. It was for the Red campaign. And the song was okay. And I noticed that I didn't run out and get it. And nor did I really even go listen to it again. And I was trying to figure out why is that. And it's because to me, it was still like that wasn't their big official artistic statement. And so I thought, is this just me? Is it that I just didn't care? Or was it just wasn't the super hit song, so I didn't care? I was comparing that to when Small Town Poets, when we started making music again, the first thing we did was we released a single. And we emailed all our fans. We had built up some fan lists again. We had emailed all of them and put it on Noise Trade to collect fans. And emailed it to press and all that, crickets. And even as we were starting to be more active online and playing some shows and getting together to record, and it was clearly, for those paying attention, something was happening. All those people kept asking, when are we going to get some new, they had no concept that single had just been released. And And a lot of the response was, well, we'll just wait till it comes out on the album. So, it's not a perfect anecdote, but it's one that, like, there are still fans that the single, it's just not motivating. It doesn't feel like it's the real thing. And I'm sure that that will fade at some point, but we do still live in a world that understands that an album release means something, and maybe just, hey, I've got this new single. And even if you're U2 publicizing it to the whole world, it doesn't really make your career.
Well, part of me wonders if this is also not just genre-based, but generational. Like, I imagine at that point, most of your fans are sort of like 35 and older.
Or probably
30 and older. And so that makes sense. The single didn't captivate them an idea. So, but yeah. I wonder if, like, younger people who have sort of grown up in this kind of instant internet world are way more comfortable with that and way more.
The other thing I was at, it was also pre-streaming too. Streaming existed, but it was 2014. I can't remember. Maybe it was 2013 when we did that. And who wants to download an individual track and have to figure out what to do with it?
Oh yeah, that is the worst.
So anyway, that was kind of my experience. And then lastly, I just think that there's still a level of perceived importance by the fan community around an album. So those were all my things. Those are all my buckets that I put it in, and that I tried to think about it strategically. There's some reasons why an album makes sense. Cost wise, there was some things to consider. Fans, the fan experience. Is something to consider. And while I didn't mention it here, there was an article that we had last year that said that the number one way people discover other music is from a different song by that same artist. And it was right there by, YouTube. It was like, where do you discover music from? YouTube, another song by that same artist. And so those are things that if you only have one song out there, it's not going to give them anything else to listen to if they like it.
Unless there are other singles.
Yep. So how do we wrap this up? How do we make sense of this all, Chris?
Well, I mean, I keep putting out albums, so I guess really in our hearts, we're both on the same side. But I don't know. Maybe another way to look at it is put out albums when you can, but if you just have songs that kind of don't fit in an album format or they don't live well with other songs, put them out as singles. If you're still proud of them, you know, I've got songs like that where I left it off an album, not because I didn't like it. I just didn't feel like it was the right place for it. So
I must not have written the note down that I thought was the counter argument where you said, if you artistically, you can do something weird and wacky. I actually think the album allows you to do something more weird and wacky, because if you just release a song that's just this weird song, and I've experienced that with some artists that I like, and it was more of an EP, but Radiohead's done some stuff like that where it's just like that King of Limbs was just such a right turn, and it was kind of an EP, and you're like, what is this?
But King of Limbs was a full album.
Yeah, it was. It was 10 tracks.
I don't know if it was 10 tracks, but it was like, in terms of its length, it was probably like 40 minutes or so.
But I think if you did that as and there were some people that really convinced themselves they loved that record. And then there was the rest of us. that if you did that as one individual song, which was such a different direction than things they had done before, I think it's harder to get traction on that idea with your fans. Like, they might just think, oh, they were just screwing around, and this isn't who they are. Where with an album, if you're actually trying to make an artistic direction and be like, hey, we're actually growing in this way, I think it's easier to provide a nice feast, musical feast for your fans to feast on, instead of a little snack here or a little appetizer and them not understand the context for it. So
I think that's the answer to the question. What do your fans want right now? Do they want a snack or a feast?
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't want a feast. Sometimes a snack will do.
Maybe they just had a feast. And
that's true. Like, sometimes when I'm working out, I just want something that's upbeat. Do you have an upbeat song? Play me that one. I don't want to hear your weepy songs. Well, I'm sure there's lots of opinions on this. and I would love to hear all of them. So you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or leave comments in the show notes for this episode at cdbabypodcast.com. And we do have some calls, and one is related to this. Actually, it's an email. So let's get to the emails. And the first email was from Asher. He wrote in, "So I was just listening to the latest podcast, and when you were talking about the single album debate at the end, you completely left out EPs. Is the format obsolete or otherwise not very useful? I ask with the perhaps foolish intent of working primarily in that form, like what is an EP useful for, if anything?" And I responded to him saying that, well, I was kind of just lumping in EPs to the album format, and that's what I would consider an EP more of, like an album. Because really, usually what an EP is for independent artists is that they have four or five songs. And I think that's much better than just the individual song, in my opinion. And I have actually done that with the band I had here in Portland, Hello Morning. Our first album had five tracks on it. And honestly, it was just enough because the songs were all very solid and there was no filler. And we actually got some pretty good attention from people in the radio industry here in town. They were spinning the songs and it felt like that was enough to make a statement of who we are without any extra stuff that wasn't needed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice bridge between the two concepts, too, in terms of all those things we mentioned. Cost, you know, if you're budgeting by time, hopefully it costs you about half as much to record. And five songs is also, I bet, like, for those of us that still do like to listen to multiple songs by an artist, like, I bet that's pretty ideal. Like, right around that sixth song, you might start getting sick of the person, but yeah. I've never put an EP out either. I should do that. Because I love the idea of them, and I love listening to them from bands that I like.
I do as well. I actually have seen people do some really cool things around an EP strategy, like breaking up an album and releasing three EPs over the course of the year, and it kind of keeps things interesting. I've seen lots of people do like one for each season and cater it to that season, especially if you start to see some distinct kind of vibe between certain songs where grouping them together EP-wise makes sense. Yeah, I think an EP, you can still get the press interested, which is what we had, and we still got some decent press coverage for that particular EP. And so it can work as a album strategy, but I think, you know, depending on what you're doing, it may mean that, you know, maybe you combine two EPs to make CDs on. Like if you only have four songs, you do two 4-song EPs, and maybe you wait till the second EP is released, and then you have a CD with both EPs on it that gives you something to sell at shows. So I'd be curious to see what other people are doing. And, you know, this is very genre-specific. This whole debate discussion is very genre-specific for certain genres. But, you know, we try to keep it general audience acceptable. So this is my advice to a general audience.
I'm for those keeping track, I'm having some emails from other venues to me about my problem that I mentioned at the beginning of the show.
Oh, good. Maybe this
looks like now my problem is I have to choose between like three or four different places.
And they may even end up being better.
Yeah.
Thank you, Asher, for the email. And the interesting thing is he actually made it all the way to the end of that episode. That was a long episode.
Well done.
And he was still engaged. All right. Charlie writes, "First, I want to say that this is hands down the best music business podcast out there. You guys keep it up after all these years and with such relevant content to us musicians. I've listened to all the podcasts I can find on sync licensing, but I can't find something on specifics of finding and contacting people in the industry, such as music supervisors. What I've heard so far is find them on the internet and email them, but they never go into specifics, almost like they're hiding their trade secrets or something. And I know that cold emailing isn't always the best way to go about it. So can we get an episode on proper email etiquette, maybe where to find seminars or conventions that are geared toward meeting these people, effective ways to submit music to them, other than the passive websites like Music X-Ray, etc. One thing as an artist that I've always struggled with is one of the main things that might launch my music career to the next level, and that's networking and being social. If you can create an episode with all these things in mind, it would be gold to me and my musicians and many musicians out there. Thanks and have a great day." And that was from Charlie.
That's a great idea for an episode.
The first thing I would say is some people are probably not giving away their trade secrets. That's part of it.
The rest of them are hiding.
Yeah. Actually, I will say that music supervisors are far easier to find online than you would ever imagine. And I don't want to give away all the secrets, mainly because, not because I don't want you to know, but because I want you to do a little work, because work filters out people who are just cluttering up inboxes and not very serious about getting a song placed. But I will tell you this. First, go to IMDb. That is the Internet Movie Database. Search the shows that you are hearing music in that sound just like what you do. From there, it'll tell you who's the music supervisor on that show. And then get on Google and social networks and see what you can track down. From there, don't start spamming them. Don't add them to your email list. That'll just anger them. Do a little more research and find out how they like to receive music. Some of them have this very, very out there and up front on their website of how I want to receive music. And if you don't follow their instructions, they will delete your email. And it's different for everybody. Some of them like CDs still. Some of them want a link. Some of them want an MP3 attached to the email. So you need to find out these things, and then you need to only contact them if you have music that fits productions they're working on. So don't contact them if you make hip-hop music and the show that they're working on uses only 60s pop music. They won't use it because they're using 60s pop music, and a lot of that's dictated by the show and the vibe of the show. In fact, we have gotten quite a few placements in a show that does use 60s pop music. CD Baby has this past couple months because we have a lot of bands, like original albums from the 60s, and it's a show that's based in the 60s. So they're loving all this 60s rock and roll, and that fits the vibe of the show. And if I was trying to pitch EDM to them, they would get frustrated and angry because they're never going to use it. Even if they like your track, it's about how it gets used in their production. So that's a place to start. And if you actually follow through with those things, you will discover more than you realized is out there with their email front and center and instructions on how to submit music. Now, they're not going to instantly email you back. There's a rare occasion where that might happen. You might just catch them at the right time. They open your email, they click on the track, and it's exactly what they need. I've heard plenty of stories of that happening. But chances are you're just going to need to follow up every once in a while. Keep it simple. Don't tell them your life story. Just keep it about the production. It's okay to mention that, hey, I really am enjoying the music you select for production X. My music fits there. I'm an independent artist. I own the rights to this and am easy to work with and would love to get a track in your show. That's going to do better than they don't care about your career as an artist. That's not what their job is. Their job is to get music that fits the vibe of the show. So if you do those things, you'll get further than you will just by randomly spamming people. Anything you want to add in there, Chris?
No, great advice.
All right. So, Charlie, thanks for the email. All right, we've got one more email, then we have a call. All right, here's the email. Hi, guys. Mark Marinick here from New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks so much for all you do. CD Baby has been the best tool for my band, and the podcast has helped us immensely. We recently started performing out of our home state of Connecticut by simply booking shows in towns where we have families such as aunts, uncles, cousins, etc. We've been able to perform 5 hours away from home and still draw 10 to 15 people along with a place to crash for the night, which helps save money also. My question is, and sorry if this has been answered before, are there any specific permits to play in another country? We are only 5 hours from Quebec, Canada, and have a large family base there. How can we make it into another country with a trailer full of gear? By the way, we bring a full upright piano to all of our shows. Before we start booking the market, we want to make sure we can make it through the border. Let me know your thoughts on this if you could. And their group is called Laney and the Wildfire. I think that's how you pronounce it. And it says, thanks again, Mark. The laws...
Fill out lots of paperwork.
Yeah, the laws can change at a drop of a hat. If there's a trade agreement... If there's any sort of border issue, so it can change. So I would recommend you talk to the immigration services of each country. But I will tell you that, believe it or not, Canada is one of the hardest places to go do this in. So it's been a while since I've done it. I've talked to an artist just a couple years ago who did and almost got busted by the Canadian Border Patrol. I don't know if they have a specific name for that crew, but so basically taking a trailer full of stuff, you're going to have to go off into some garage and potentially they could make you take every single piece of thing out of your van and trailer to prove that you're not smuggling anything in or out.
And they probably will, not just could. Like, that's totally red flag.
Well, fortunately for us, when we did it, and now this was pre-9/11, when we did it, we had a full-size tour bus and a trailer, and we were going to be crossing the border like at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning, and fortunately, we all woke up, we were in Detroit, and we didn't have to pile out all groggy and unload our stuff, but it depends. It depends on what's going on, and so that's one issue. You will need time to cross the border, and they will ask you whether or not you have work permits. Because if you're going to get paid, you have to have a permit. And I ran into this just doing some traveling for CD Baby, speaking at a conference in Canada. They were asking me, what are you doing here? I'm speaking at this conference. Are you getting paid? And I was not getting paid. And that made it fine. If I was getting paid, I would have had to fill out all these forms and technically should have had a work visa. So that's the thing. If you're going to go and get paid to play, you're going to have to get a secure work visa. If you're just playing house concerts, that's kind of under the table. I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the U.S., you could easily get away with saying you weren't working because you're not working for a business and they're not giving you a paycheck.
As long as if you're trying to keep it hush-hush like that, you also need to remember to keep those dates off of your website, because they'll go and they'll look up your band name and they'll look at your tour calendar and see that you're playing in Toronto or whatever. And
yeah, and also the other thing that's a tip off is merch. And this is the artist that I talked to a couple years ago that ran into some issues, a hip-hop artist, and he was doing some rap battles in Canada. And he, I don't think, was getting paid, but he brought a ton of merchandise. And they opened it up and fortunately didn't do some digging because he had a lot of flyers. And that's another thing, having flyers to promote the show clearly seems like a commercial event. And he said it was all just promotional, and so they let him through. But I don't recommend misrepresenting what you're doing in the country. These are just stories I've heard. So it is something that you don't just go, hey, someone in Canada invited us to play a show. We're just going to drive on up there, do the gig, and come home and get paid $500. It's not that easy. Other countries I've gone to Asia, I've gone to Europe, and I've gone to Africa. It's been different every place. It's never been the same. It's country by country. But out of all the ones I've been to, Canada seemed to be the most intense. There were some countries in Europe that were going to charge tax to one of the other bands we were playing with just to bring their gear into the country, sort of like an import tax. And it was going to be, I think in one place they paid like $1,000 just to bring their gear in the country. So you should definitely do some research. And like I said, it changes because laws change, trade agreements change, and it's all based on that kind of stuff. So it can be hairy. So yeah, do some research. Don't get to the border and be going, because those guys, they don't mess around.
Yeah. The only time I've toured up there, I played, I think, 4 shows. Well, a small tour. I did not bring my guitar. I did bring like a box of maybe, I don't know, 25 or 50 CDs in my suitcase, and then just drove as if I was a tourist, and then borrowed a guitar when I was up there. So that was my covert sneaking into Canada story.
Are there really that many people trying to sneak into Canada? It's cold up there.
Yes, but, well, I won't get into politics.
All right, please don't. Okay, we have one phone call for today. It's from Eric from Chicago, and I'm going to play it right now.
Hello, CD Baby Podcast. This is Eric from Chicago. I really, really love the show and really love some of the topics you guys have been having over the past few weeks. And it's really got me thinking about some of the ways that I've been applying that with my wife and our project that we have that has become really, really successful. And I see a lot of the ways, a lot of things that we've done right in what you talk about. And I just kind of wanted to share my experience with you and with the community. Our album, our project kind of was born out of a few years ago when we had a new child and didn't really want to be doing what we were doing for our jobs, and we were going in a new direction. My wife, she's always been a singer, and we got the idea to do children's music, to just try that out. And, before really had anything to show for it, the relationship of pictures and social media and how putting that forward really helped our brand. She had no shows, no leads for shows or anything like that. And she had this concept of Miss Jamie from the farm and playing at farmers markets and doing that and just seeing if that would be a good outlet for her music and for hopefully some income. So anyway, so she started, calling these places and, they have no budget and they're like, no, you can't play basically. And she says, well, how about I play and you let me take pictures? They said, okay, no problem. So she did a bunch of shows, just her. And actually our daughter, who was like a 1-year-old at the time. So she's doing a bunch of shows, to very, very small audiences, wearing our daughter Taylor in her carrier while she's performing. And so she's got all these great pictures of, her playing for kids while wearing a child. She did a lot of shows like this, and every single show that she did, she would make sure that pictures were taken on her smartphone or whatever, and then she would post about it on social media, and she made it like an event every single show. And, so then there was this buzz that was going about her, and people then started wanting to book her because they're like, oh, Miss Jamie from the farm, I've heard of you. And so that was kind of using social media to our advantage and using photos to our advantage, where we didn't really have anything else to go on. And, moving forward, and we did our album, which was has been really successful for us, and continuing to grow. And now we do between 40 and 60 shows a month, every single month, a lot of days in the summer, 2 or 3 shows a day, every single day of the week. It's a lot of shows. That's how pictures and social media have really helped our brand. Anyway, we've gone from making nowhere near enough money to making enough money to live on with our music career. And I just wanted to share our story and how it relates to some of the stuff that I've heard in the show. Hope that is some helpful insight for you guys, and have a great show. Love the podcast. Bye.
Well, thanks for the call, Eric. I liked how you sort of retooled what you guys were doing and sort of focused in on the kids' music thing. But I like the idea that you were really using photos as a strategy to build the story. And that's kind of what my takeaway was, that how important it was to spread the word visually that you're actually out playing and doing a lot of things, and people start catching on and it starts building this story, and people magnify the story in their heads, and it's easy to start snowballing something just because people will infer their own, I don't know, whatever.
Well, it's like they function as testimonials. So
yeah,
anyone that sees them is going to feel like, if I go to one of these, I'm going to have a similar experience and have fun and we'll have a smile on my face or whatever.
Or if I book that artist, that they've got a long history of performing and doing things. So mm-hmm. I think that's, to me, with the work that with the shows Small Town Poets is able to do, that's why I'm like, one of the most important things is that we get a photographer out there, because we don't play much. But if we get a bunch of pictures, we can still build a story, even if we're not out on the road. But if we played just like last year, we just played one show, or it was like 2 shows. We had a photographer take a bunch of photos, and throughout the Christmas season where we still had, people were still, our Christmas album, living a new life, benefit of doing a holiday album every year. Every year it's fresh. There was more content for us to put out there, and it just makes it feel like Small Town Poets is out there for the whole Christmas season doing stuff, and it feels, it tells a bigger story. And so that's why I like the idea of really thinking through, like, maybe it is the trade-off, I'm not getting paid to play, but if they allow me to really take photos and promote it, and then they start promoting it to their community, it can snowball quickly and move on to bigger and better things.
So I need to remember to get people to take lots of pictures tomorrow night.
You do. And then you need to write a whole story about how this thing went down.
Hopefully it goes down. We'll see. Next week, everyone will find out.
Thanks, Eric from Chicago. And speaking of Chicago, Eric, I better see you at the DIY Musician Conference September 30th through October 2nd because it's in Chicago. You really have no excuse. Plenty of time to clear out your schedule. Which, by the way, we have some really exciting announcements for that coming up, and I can't wait to make them. It's going to be such a good event that if you're not in Chicago, I feel sorry for you.
Well, that's why we have discounted hotel room rates for anyone who doesn't live in Chicago.
That's right. And if you can't afford a hotel room, you can crash in Chris's room. Huh. I give you that permission.
I'll be sure I get one of the haunted rooms.
Yeah, actually, I had a conversation with somebody who was telling me that really bothered them.
That the hotel was haunted?
Presumably haunted. It's an old hotel, I will say. It's a very old hotel. Lots of history.
I don't think all of the wings of the hotel we had reserved for guests, none of them were the haunted section.
No, and I talked to some people that were walking around looking for it, and they found the door. I think they showed me the door. It wasn't that creepy.
Because there wasn't a ghost around it.
There's a whole different podcast about that. Totally different show, but I might like listening to that show. But yeah, we hope to see everyone in Chicago. That's definitely coming up. And if you'd like to call our listener line, 360-524-2209, I'd love to hear your thoughts, comments on releasing singles versus albums, strategies you've tried. I'd love to get to your just general success stories or some funny moments, some things you've learned, some mistake stories, anything you want to share with us. We want to hear it. We want to put on the show. You can also email us podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or go to the podcast website and leave some comments in the show notes. Anything else we need to say before we sign off, Chris?
No, I think we covered everything.
I think we better let you go so you can go get your venue situation straightened out because...
I know, I've been stressed the whole time, gotta figure this out. So I'll go do that now.
Do that now. And please, 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 if you end up in the back of a police wagon, make sure someone's videoing it. Because if no one gets it on video, what was the whole point?
I always take your advice.
All right. And it's free. You don't even have to. There's no consulting fee. All right. Well, you have an amazing release show, and I look forward to hearing about it next time.
Thanks.
All right. See ya.
Have a good one. Peace.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.